Rogers. From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Kojo Namdi Show. It's Tech Tuesday. Rumors fly fast in high school and college hallways. Students often whisper about their friends, their enemies, and all those teachers who get on their nerves. But what happens when those conversations move onto the internet? The loose talk that takes place online might as well be shouted from a giant megaphone. Schools are scrambling to keep tabs on these conversations so that no one, kids or adults, get hurt in front of a worldwide audience. But how far can they go to discipline students for things that are said outside of the classroom? Joining us in our studio to have that Tech Tuesday conversation is John Morris, who is general counsel at the Center for Democracy and Technology. John is also an adjunct professor at the Cardozo Law School. John Morris, thank you for joining us. Good to see you again.
Good to see you. Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Adam Thierer, who is a senior fellow at the Progress and Freedom Foundation. That's a market-oriented think tank that studies the digital revolution and its implications for public policy. Adam, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Passing notes under the desk, scribbling on the bathroom walls, that's so 1995. These days, if students have an axe to grind, they take it to the web. How has the rumor mill changed in the digital age, John?
Well, I mean, I think that what we're seeing is that what used to happen on the playground or in the hallways does happen online, and the implications are that it happens much more quickly, it gets out to a much larger group of people, and probably most important, it's persistent, so that, you know, it, instead of a taunt on the playground that just goes away, it's a taunt online that then everyone can read and stew about for the next 5 weeks, you know, and get really upset about. So it really has changed the dynamic in a way, but at the end of the day, it really is the same type of bickering among students and complaining about teachers that's been going on for generations.
Adam?
Well, the internet has amplified the platform, if you will, that kids can stand on and gripe about what they don't like at school, whether it be their fellow classmates, their teachers, their homework, whatever else. The problem, of course, is that once you get on the internet, it can be an open book for all to see. It's not a private diary. It's not a hallway conversation. It's not locker room or playground talk. And we used to always joke in the old days, at least our parents did, about how you got to be careful or this will go down on your permanent record.
Right.
Well, it was always a bit of a fib because, of course, there was no permanent record in the old days. But today, the internet is becoming sort of the equivalent of a permanent record. And that's the real danger, is that this content, this material can come back to haunt kids for a long time.
Well, some people behave differently online because they assume a different identity there. But a lot of young people use sites like Facebook where their words are attached to their real names. Why are they so willing to talk freely on those sites? Adam, I suspect a little bit has to do with what you talked about permanently. When I was a young person, the word permanent had no meaning for me. I knew, A, that I'd never die, and B, that anything that I said would probably not last for very long. It was very difficult for me at that time to conceive of something being permanent. Is that one of the reasons, in addition to the fact that when they're online, they're generally without parental supervision and feel as if they are just in a private conversation with friends?
I think that's certainly part of it. And add to that the fact that when we communicate online, sitting in front of our computers and our keyboards, we feel we are at a bit of a distance between those who we are talking about or with. And therefore, there's a feeling that perhaps, well, I can say certain things here and in this context that I wouldn't otherwise say face-to-face. And that is a problem. I mean, there are certainly things that are said online that are hurtful, sometimes even harmful, because kids don't stop before they click and think about what they're going to say because that person is at a distance. Certainly, they wouldn't probably say the same things if that person was staring them face-to-face.
John, does the digital generation have to be more responsible with the way they use words than their parents had to be?
Well, I think that's exactly right. I mean, it's really our whole society has to evolve, and it is evolving in terms of just figuring out what are the boundaries and what are the norms now. And it's not just kids who are putting a lot of stuff up online. It's, you know, certainly 20-somethings and some 30-somethings are pretty active online. But I think our society is adjusting to a more open, a more visible life that one has. And I think in 15 years, the people who are hiring will not be that concerned about the somewhat disturbing stuff that one might find from, you know, an applicant from Facebook. So, I mean, I think we're in a transition where, you know, people are realizing that there are consequences for putting this stuff out there. So they're being a little bit more cautious about putting stuff out there. At least one study in Florida has suggested that students on Facebook are putting a little bit less information out about themselves than they did 5 years ago.
But you're saying that the other side of that coin is that people who look at this stuff 15 years from now may not look at it in the same way that we would look at it today, because they will be, they operate on a I guess, a different paradigm, so to speak?
Well, you know, actually, a young person said to me just last week, said to me that when she is hiring someone in 20 years, she's going to be suspect of someone of an applicant who doesn't have a Facebook page that tells about their whole life. So, I mean, you know, it's hard for me to predict really what our attitude will be like, but I do think that some indiscretions that you see on Facebook, as long as they're not really going to, you know, your moral character. I mean, if it looks like you got drunk on some Saturday night and you put a picture up on Facebook, you know, I'm not sure that's going to be a big deal in 15 years.
It's a Tech Tuesday conversation on online speech and students. You can join us by calling 800-433-8850. How much privacy should students be given when they interact on the web? You can give us your opinion, 800-433-8850, or send email to kojo@wamu.org. Joining us now by telephone from Los Angeles is Perry F. Taub, who is executive director of wiredsafety.org. Perry, thank you very much for joining us.
I appreciate being invited.
I guess we have all seen that YouTube video, or some of us may have seen it on television, of that young woman being beaten up by a number of her so-called friends, I guess we would say associates in that situation. How is bullying or harassment different when it takes place online or when it shows up online?
Well, the particular video that everyone's seen is one of thousands and perhaps tens of thousands of them on the Internet. A lot of kids are now engaging in virtual fights where they're beating people up and hurting them in serious ways to become more famous. The Internet has allowed people to misbehave in a way they consider anonymous. As we teach our young people to behave properly, it comes from teaching them good morals, it comes from supervision so that teachers and parents and law enforcement and their friends curtail behavior that has crossed the line between appropriate and inappropriate. So that if you're acting out too much, your friends may say, come on, enough, let's stop, or a teacher may pull you away.
However,
but online, most of the time, you're on your own, and no one is curtailing your behavior.
What do you suggest about how we do curtail that kind of behavior?
Well, it takes, I hate to say it, it takes a village. The industry needs to be better at risk management. We need to teach the kids themselves that there are repercussions and they can be held accountable for what they're doing. We need to teach parents that this is going on. It's going to take a large group. In fact, we're holding a huge international cyberbullying conference, the first of its kind in New York in June, to deal with this from everyone's aspect, from the media, from law enforcement, from the regulatory government perspective, from community, and from the Internet industry and the kids themselves.
Well, when we say the Internet industry, we're talking about something very broad, but I get the impression that you feel that YouTube is a particular villain in this.
Well, I don't know that YouTube's a villain. YouTube is a technology. The problem is that it's being misused very often. At the same time, we put our Internet safety videos on YouTube. So I think we need to recognize that the technology is neutral when it comes to good and bad, but what we need to do is teach the sites how to manage risks better. They need to, although they can't review all of the videos that are up there, they need to keep a special eye on those that use tagging and keywords that denote that they are using violent fights And those can be reviewed before they go up to keep kids from becoming famous before we put them in jail.
Also joining us now by telephone from Chicago is Reg Weaver, who is the president of the National Education Association. Reg Weaver, good to have you aboard. Thank you for joining us.
Well, good morning, and thank you.
Teachers are in a unique position because they spend so much time with students. What do you and the NEA recommend that schools should be doing to address online bullying and harassment?
Well, one of the things that we would suggest is to make sure that we communicate with the parents, make sure that we communicate with the other educators to let them know that today is a different age as it relates to technology. You know, we think that there are a number of tactics that we can use. Tell the person that that is harassing you to cease and desist. If in fact we know who that person is, I think we should tell somebody that we trust that something is happening to me or to the student, so that we can have somebody to intervene and possibly curtail that particular action.
Are there signs that teachers might be able to look for in student behavior that might give a clue as to whether or not they are participating in cyberbullying?
Yeah, I think we should watch out for folks, for the young people who kind of close their screens suddenly when the teacher comes by, or be careful of those students who sit in groups while they are on the internet instead of sitting alone. And also, I think we ought to adopt a school-wide anti-bullying program. So I think these are some of the kinds of things that educators can do as it relates to students.
In my
day, also, you know, it's a good thing, too. We might invite some experts in. We might invite some law enforcement personnel in to talk to students about cyber lobbying.
We're talking about online speech and students on this Tech Tuesday. Reg Weaver is president of the National Education Association. He joins us along with Perry F. Taub, executive director of WiredSafety.org. Adam Thierer is a senior fellow at the Progress and Freedom Foundation. And John Morris is general counsel at the Center for Democracy and Technology. And we're taking your calls at 800-433-8850. How should schools discipline students who say unruly things online? Give us a call, 800-433-8850. John, what rules do you have for your own children about how they use the web and how they behave online?
Well, I mean, I've tried to instill in my kids who are 10 and 12 that what you say online will be permanent in all likelihood. And so I've certainly encouraged them to adopt a very privacy-sensitive approach that I also personally have. But, I mean, with my daughter, who's, you know, in the middle of, you know, beginning with email, we already have seen, you know, email that is nasty to other students, and we've talked about that. So I think really that the most important thing that a parent should do is to talk with your kids and to be aware of the interactions, especially that your younger kids are having over email. My daughter knows that I have access to her email, so I am able to see what she's getting into. At some point, I will stop that. I will allow her to have more privacy in her email. But until I know that she's really developed a sense of responsibility, I want to be involved.
Adam, same question.
I think that's excellent advice from John, and I think so much of the problem here, Kojo, goes back to the fact that we face a bit of a generational gap, if you will, in terms of technology and the fact that this current generation of parents were caught unaware, if you will, of these rapid technological changes that have reshaped society and communications and media content. The good news, however, is that a new generation of parents is coming online, if you will, and I'm one of them. My kids are both under the age of 7, but I'm fully immersed in this digital and new communications environment, very comfortable with these technologies. I know better how to talk to my kids about these technologies, the potential dangers and benefits of them, but more importantly, how to use proper forms of etiquette, or what I like to call netiquette, if you will, when they are all online, about how they should treat others or their teachers.
You know, Perry, I want to get back to the issue of how teachers deal with students for a second. Reg Weaver was talking about some of the things that teachers might be able to do. It's my understanding that you'd like schools to talk about cyberbullying issues at times that are specifically inconvenient for students. Could you explain what you mean by that?
Yes. We have other programs that are more efficient, though. We've got the Megan Pledge, where we want 1 million kids to take a pledge against cyberbullying by the end of the year in honor of Megan Meyer, the young girl who killed herself after being harassed by a mother posing as a young boy online. But when public schools are faced with what they can do to discipline students for what they do off campus after hours to torment each other, the only thing they can do, for the most part, unless they have a written cyberbullying policy, which we recommend, is to call the parents in and talk to them. I find to get parents to pay attention to this, if the more inconvenient the meeting can be, the more seriously angry the parents are over this, and maybe will take it seriously themselves. So the school doesn't have the legal authority to discipline the students for what happens off campus. Bringing the parents in and talking to them gives the parents puts the onus on the parents to do something about it.
What do you think about that, Reg Weaver?
I think it's absolutely right on target. I think a lot of times many of the young people, They are excited about the opportunity to participate on the cyberspace, but thinking that there is no responsibility that goes with it. And sometimes the parents don't pay as much attention as we would like as to what the kid is doing. So if, in fact, as she has indicated, you make it inconvenient for them and make it mandatory that they attend, and if they don't attend, then, something has to have some consequences with the kid. But, yeah, a lot of times this stuff is serious, and many kids need to understand that in terms of how things happen as it results to damaging other individuals, cyberspace is no different than doing it verbally, and so they have to be responsible for what the consequences might be as a result of inappropriate behavior.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll carry on this Tech Tuesday conversation about online speech and students. If you've called already, stay on the line. The number is 800-433-8850. If the lines are busy, shoot us an email. Shoot us an email anyway to Kojo, K-O-J-O, at WAMU.org. I'm Kojo Nnamdi.
Good afternoon. I'm Matt McCleskey, and this is WAMU 88.5. Coming up at 2 o'clock, it's Tell Me More.
When neo-soul singer Angie Stone found out she was diabetic, she not only took steps to take care of herself, but made it her business to try to help other African Americans do the same.
What I've managed to do is go from state to state and city to city to promote the awareness of the disease.
I'm Michelle Martin. We'll learn more about Angie Stone's crusade for health next time on Tell Me More.
That's coming up at 2 on WAMU 88.5.
The Splendid Table is a show for people who love to eat. Hi, I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. If you like good conversation, food, and wine, then join me on Friday, May 2nd at 7:30 p.m. at the historic Anderson House in DuPont Circle when WAMU 88.5 hosts a reception inspired by my new book, The Splendid Table's How to Eat Supper. Share your passion for the culinary delights with other public radio fans. For tickets and information, visit WAMU.org, and we'll see you there.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from CDWG. With thousands of technology products in stock, they're there to get public sector customers what they need when they need it on purchasing vehicles specific to their organizations. CDWG, the right technology right away. From the University of Maryland, Baltimore County's Department of Information Systems, offering an online master's program in information systems. Applications for summer semester are due May 11th. Information is at www.onlinems.umbc.edu.
Welcome back to this Tech Tuesday conversation on online speech and students with Reg Weaver, president of the National Education Association, Perry F. Taub, executive director of WiredSafety.org, Adam Thierer, senior fellow at the Progress and Freedom Foundation. That's a think tank that studies the digital revolution and its implications for public policy. And John Morris, who is general counsel at the Center for Democracy and Technology and a professor at the Cardoza School of Law. John, so far we've been talking about younger students, but let's talk about college students for a second, because a lot of students talk badly about their professors on the Internet. Have you ever been tempted to go online and check out what your law students might be saying about you, If not, what's stopped you?
I'll admit that I have looked at the at the ratemyprofessors.com site. And
yeah, I was at that site this morning. There's some cold things being said at that site.
There are, but thankfully nothing is being said about me, and I'm quite happy about that. Although the course I teach is cyber law, so I suspect that all of my students know that I might be familiar with the site, and they might be a little hesitant, although it is obviously an anonymous site. One can pseudonymize.
But what would you do? What would it take for you to report what you found to school administrator?
Well, you know, at the end of the day, if someone speaks ill of me online in that context, you know, I think that's their right to do it. If they threaten me, if they actually, you know, say something that truly is a true threat under the legal standard, well then I think the school could take action against that person. But I mean, I personally, at least in that academic setting of criticism of professors, think that that's a pretty core right that students ought to be able to be critical of their professors, as long as it's not in a truly defamatory or harmful or threatening way.
What happens if it's in a truly defamatory or harmful way, Adam Thera?
Well, there can be lawsuits brought, of course, if it crosses a certain line. Now, we have a high threshold in this country, and I think wisely so, with regards to defamation law, because we cherish our free speech rights. And it's, generally speaking, a good thing that there are sites and services where kids and others can go and comment on their teachers or other types of things that are happening in society. I don't think we want to chill that sort of speech. What I think we need to work towards is to find a way, when lines are crossed, before we rush to judgment or rush to the law as a solution, we need to find what I call non-legal intervention strategies, basically ways to work together in communities, schools, with parents, with the students, and those potentially harmed, to talk about these issues, talk them through, to see if there might be ways to resolve them or adjudicate them before they escalate into a really heated war of words or go legal. Because that's what we don't want. And we specifically don't want laws like we've seen coming out of Congress in recent years or the states that would aggressively try to regulate the internet or these social networking sites, potentially either banning them outright in educational institutions and libraries or demanding that everyone forego their anonymity online and have to be identity verified before they get onto these sites or services.
Reg Waver, you've been a teacher. What would it take when you're teaching a class and you go online and you see your students saying critical things about you? What would it take for the line to be crossed? Would it have to be something extremely personal of a sexual or racial nature?
Well, I guess, you know, again, it depends on what the content is, and depends on in terms of how it is listed online. I would have a tendency to look at what is online and look at that in the same manner as I would if somebody were saying something to me verbally. So, again, whether it's online or whether it's verbal, I think that I would look to see what it is. And then, who is saying it, and then have a conversation with them and possibly have a conversation with their parents.
There have been cases, though, John Morris, have there, of people who have sued for defamation?
There have been. Teachers have won settlement, at least, in Florida and Indiana. There's an ongoing case right now in Texas where the assistant principal is suing a student who created a false MySpace page where the student pretended to be the principal and created a somewhat lewd page on MySpace. So there is that kind of litigation going on, and in fact, students and their families have had to pay teachers in those cases. And I think that's one thing that we will see. We'll probably see more of as our whole country gets acclimated to this new digital age, just like, I mean, to look at a different area, just like we see, we've seen lawsuits brought by the recording industry for peer-to-peer copyright violations, where in fact now I think students today realize that there is a risk if you're going to go violate the law and share files, so they're more sensitive to that. I think students will increasingly realize that that if you go say something inappropriate about a teacher, there is a legal risk out there.
Go ahead.
I think also, you know, many students are victimized, but sometimes they don't say anything because they fear that if in fact more adults are involved, that it will make the situation worse. So I think that we have to also be cognizant of the number of students that might be being victimized.
Absolutely.
By this.
Go ahead, please, Perry.
We've done extensive research on this, and we found that only 5% of the middle schoolers would ever tell an adult at all if they're being cyber harassed or cyber bullied, because they're afraid of the consequences. They're afraid that they're going to lose internet privileges. Parents are going to make it worse. Someone's going to blame them. Maybe they did something to start it off. 57 different reasons why they won't tell their parents or another trusted adult. But bottom line, they're not telling.
What advice do you have for students about protecting their online reputations? You can call us at 800-433-8850. Here's Jen at Fairfax Station, Virginia. Jen, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Kojo. I enjoy your show. I'm a family therapist and mother of three, and I could not live without RateMyTeachers.com. It is a wonderful tool for parents and teachers to get honest assessments. You know, teachers are largely unmonitored. You're talking about the consumers in this system are the parents and the students, and teachers and administrators lose sight of that. And without this tool, we will never know, because there's very little supervision, a small amount of evaluation that's legitimate, and we'll never know what's actually going on in the classroom. And when we have incompetent and abusive teachers, the only way we can get consistent information, and you know what? Their ratings are right on. From what I've read, 100%, 97% accuracy. And if anything, they bend over backwards to be gratuitous to the teachers.
Well,
not say negative things about
them. Educate me here. Is there a distinction between RateMyTeachers.com and RateMyProfessors.com?
RateMyTeachers is for elementary, middle, and high school, and RateMyProfessors is for college level.
Okay, you use RateMyTeachers.com. How do you know what's credible and what's not on the website?
Well, so far what I've noticed as a family therapist is children don't want to be in a situation, students don't want to be in a situation where they have to be negative. They would love the opportunity to be positive, to have good teachers, to have a good educational system that's inclusive, that has a high quality. Unfortunately, that doesn't happen all that much. And what I've read about teachers, it gives us the heads up, what to expect, and almost entirely honest. From my experience, I've been doing this for 30 years, and I find very little on RateMyTeachers.com that isn't right on, that isn't accurate about what you can expect. If you have an abusive teacher, then you can try to either get out of the class or adapt your style. You have to lay low so you don't get victimized, and you get victimized by the teachers.
Okay, Reg Weaver, here's what we've got here. We've got you being accountable to school boards, school superintendents, parents' organizations, and now a website, RateYourTeachers.org. How do you feel about this new layer of scrutiny?
I think the one thing that we need to be very careful of is not to try to find blame for students who are using the cyberspace in a manner that's abusive. I think the issue is anybody, whether it's a child or whether it's an adult, if, in fact, they are using the cyberspace in a manner that is abusive, in a manner that is hurtful to other folks, then there needs to be something done. It shouldn't matter whether it's the teacher that does it or whether the parent that does it. In fact, most of the abuses, I would say, probably take place in the home, on computers that are in the home. And so I think that... Again, I'm not trying to find fault with a teacher or a parent, but let's make sure that we join hands together to make sure that whatever the abusive nature is, done by whomever, that it is eradicated, because it has no place.
John Morris, help me to find a balance here. On the one hand, we have Jen saying, she finds RateMyTeachers.org, a really good website for assessing what's going on in schools. On the other hand, one of our volunteers went to RateMyProfessor.com and decided never to look at the website again because there were so, in her opinion, so many unnecessarily mean things that she found there.
Well, I think that if you go to RateMyProfessors.com, I'm frankly not as familiar with the Rate My Teachers, the type of content that's there. But if you go to the RateMyProfessors.com site, you'll see lots of vitriol. You'll see some unnecessarily, you'll see inappropriate language. But you'll also see, as I think Jen suggested, you'll see an undercurrent of truth that runs throughout the comments. And so if you have a professor that has 100 comments and 80% of them are positive comments and some of them are horribly vitriolic, well, you know, that might suggest that this professor is not a bad professor if you compare that to someone who has 75% negative comments. So, I think that you need to take with grains of salt what you read online. You need to do that in any context online. And you need to have a somewhat thicker skin to inappropriate comments, and if you're offended by that kind of comment, then you shouldn't probably go to those sites.
Okay, allow me to go to John in Olney, Maryland. Jan, thank you for your call. John, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, are students being held to a different standard than adults if I use my home computer? Is the school supposed to punish somebody that's using a home computer?
Adam?
Well, this is a difficult question. The question is, when you're sitting in your own home writing about something that takes place at school, is that a private matter or a public matter? Is it a matter for the school that they could discipline the student, or is it something that should be exclusively dealt with by the parent? Perry mentioned the fact that it may be a chance for the schools to bring in the parents if certain lines are crossed before, again, as I've said, the war of words escalates into a full-blown flame war. But these are difficult questions. There are no simple answers to these things. And I would think that for the most part, what is said online on a Facebook account or a MySpace account is for the most part a private matter and should be left alone, and schools should be policing it. But there will be times when the situation escalates and some sort of, again, non-legal intervention needs to take place either by schools, communities, or parents working
together. Well, they've had school newspapers go offline because of what they published. There's been a lot of litigation on school newspapers. And offline, they're immune.
Yeah, here's John Morris.
Yeah, the caller has hit on a topic that really has been litigated in courts a fair bit. It is clear under Supreme Court precedent that if it is if there's speech going on at a school function, a school sponsored event, then the school has a great deal of authority over that speech. If the speech is going on in a school publication such as a newspaper, again, the speech can be pretty heavily controlled by the school. But the courts are also pretty clear that if it is totally out of school, then the school really probably can't take that discipline, a disciplinary action about out-of-school speech. Actually, somewhat amusingly, one of the early cases dealt with digital expression that predated the internet. Digital being a student used his middle finger to express his opposition to a professor, a teacher that he saw in a school up in a restaurant, and the student was disciplined by the school because in a restaurant he made an obscene gesture to the teacher. And the court said, no, you can't discipline someone for their speech outside of school. Now, we're in the middle of, in the cyberbullying context, there are a bunch of state laws that have been passed, including in Maryland, that are going two different directions in this area. Some of the state laws specifically are only focused on speech that's happening at the school, using school computers, using school publications, and some of them are trying to reach speech that happens outside of the school if it has a substantial disruptive effect on the school.
Indeed, Perry Aftab, what I was thinking of is the student sitting at home in front of his or her computer at home on a MySpace or Facebook and saying, when I see such and such a person in school tomorrow, I'm going to punch him, her right in the nose. What do you do in that situation?
Well, underneath this all, I'm also a lawyer, so you've got an awful lot of lawyers on the phone.
Hey, this is Washington.
But, But if it's a threat, it's covered by cyber stalking and harassment laws that exist now. There may be many laws when it's a credible threat that the kids can be charged under and have been charged for things. I'm going to kill you. I'm going to hurt your sister. I'm going to do something like that. But what we recommend, and I think all of us agree, that we're not going to expect police to arrest every child who's doing this stuff online. They'd all be in jail tomorrow. We need to come up with other ways. And we do it two ways. We have a program called Teen Angels. They are 13 to 18-year-old teen internet safety experts. They train for at least a year, and then they go out and run their own programs and go out and talk to kids in schools. And they've created some peer counseling programs that work there. We also recommend that schools come up with a cyberbullying policy, which says, in essence, our kids are saying things to each other that may affect the educational atmosphere and the safety and well-being of the children during the school day, even though it occurs offline, you know, off school grounds after hours. And by signing below, you agree that we can treat this as though it would be an in-school offense, love and kisses, school. Now, if parents and kids sign that, you now have a contractual right for the school to deal with it as opposed to having to rely on constitutional rights.
Reg Weaver, you want to weigh in on this?
Yeah, because of increased activity as it relates to the cyber lobby here, we've kind of launched what we call a BNet Savvy, and the purpose is to educate parents. Educate parents as to, you know, what's really going on as it relates to this particular issue. The opportunity for them to read various articles by many of the experts as well as other educators and parents and other teens. But I have another question, and that is, we're talking primarily about, I'm thinking about computers, but what about cell phones? What about text messaging?
Mm-hmm.
What about instant messages? Are those in the same category as the hard drives?
Hey, we're going to have to take a short break, but that's a topic that we will address when we come back in this conversation about online speech and students' text messages on cell phones. What category do they fall into? You can call us 800-433-8850. How do you keep tabs on your child's online life? Let us know, 800-433-8850, or you can shoot us an email to kojo@wamu.org. I'm Kojo Nandi. Coming up at 1, the merits and contradictions of going green, a presidential primary showdown in Pennsylvania, and a former president's controversial effort to broker peace in the Middle East. It's your turn to set the agenda. Today at 1 on the Kojo Nandi Show on WAMU 88.5.
Good afternoon. I'm Matt McCleskey. Coming up at 2 o'clock today, it's Tell Me More with Michelle Martin.
When neo-soul singer Angie Stone found out she was diabetic, she not only took steps to take care of herself, but made it her business to try to help other African Americans do the same.
What I've managed to do is go from state to state and city to city to promote the awareness of the disease.
I'm Michelle Martin. We'll learn more about Angie Stone's crusade for health next time on Tell Me More.
That's coming up at 2 o'clock here on WAMU 88.5.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from Blattner Brunner, delivering global, national, and local communication solutions to help clients in D.C. and across the nation solve complex marketing challenges. More about Blattner Brunner is online at blattnerbrunner.com. From the University of Maryland, Baltimore County's Department of Information Systems, offering an online master's program in information systems. Applications for summer semester are due May 11th. Information is at www.onlinems.umbc.edu.
66 degrees in Northwest Washington at 12:44 as we return now to the Kojo Nandi Show on WAMU 88.5.
Well, it's Tech Tuesday and we're talking about online speech and students, but the question has been raised by Reg Weaver, president of the National Education Association, about the speech that takes place by way of cell phones and text messaging. John Morris, where does that fall?
Well, I think at the end of the day, there really shouldn't be any difference between the different types of digital technology that you use to convey information, with the exception that schools do have a greater ability to set rules about speech that happens on the campus itself. And so if certainly the middle school that my daughter goes to, as a rule of a no cell phone rule. And so, you know, I think that certainly texting during class or texting on school property is something that schools certainly can prohibit or try to control. But when we get outside of the school property, I think there really shouldn't be any significant difference between a text message or an email.
800-433-8850 is the number to call. Should employers be checking social networks to learn more about prospective employees? What should they be looking for? 800-433-8850. Here's Amanda in Great Falls, Virginia. Amanda, your turn.
Hi there. Thank you for this discussion. I think bullying is a terribly undiscussed and extremely hurtful activity, and I know as a kid I was subject to it and still bear the scars. And one thing I would like to see is a change in terminology. I believe the word bullying tends to minimize the severity of the problem. We don't talk about adults bullying each other. We talk about them harassing each other. I think the terminology needs to be consistent so that it is not diminished, the importance isn't diminished just because it's taking place among children.
Perry F. Taub, what do you think about that?
Well, it's very interesting, and I don't disagree. We're finding when we talk to kids in high school, and I talk to them about cyberbullying, they tell us that cyberbullying doesn't exist. And when I probe them further, it turns out that they know these kinds of things are happening, but they don't like to use the word bullying because it means that they're admitting that they're a victim and can't handle harassment and confrontation. So I think that when we call it bullying, it often does underrate the problem, and it's something we have to grapple with. But it is a growing trend. We're finding 85% of the middle schoolers I have polled in the United States, 45,000 of them last year, admitted that they were cyberbullied at least once, and 70% of a poll of 5,000 of them indicated that they've cyberbullied. The only difference is the last to click the mouse or hit the text messaging button.
Thank you very much for your call, Amanda. You know, sites like Juicy Campus encourage students to dish dirt about their classmates online, and the people who run these sites claim they're not legally responsible for any of that dirt. They also promise to protect the anonymity of their users. How sound are these claims legally, Adam Thierer?
Well, you know, Kojo, dishing dirt is there's a long tradition of it in America. It goes all the way back. There's gossip sites and columns and newspapers and so on and so forth. But now it's taken onto the scale of the internet, and anyone can join in the fun, if you will, and gossip. And this can be a problem at times, but there is a legitimate question, however, about to what extent should we make such sites illegal or in some way regulate them. I think, again, the question is, where is the line crossed when something that is said is that is so clearly defamatory or potentially harmful that the veil of anonymity has to disappear and we have to find a way to find that person who's behind those comments. But for the most part, most of what's dished on those sites is, as it says, juicy gossip, and I don't think we want to go into those waters of trying to regulate all of that out of existence.
Indeed, you know, John Morris, I was reading a column by Mark Fisher in the Washington Post in which he actually got in contact with a number of the people about whom dirt had been dished on various websites, people who were college students whose reputations were clearly tarnished in some way or the other. In a few of the cases, even though some of these sites had 1,000, 2,000 hits, the subject had not heard about it, and B, when the subject did hear about it, felt that there was nothing they could do to remove their name from the website or to reestablish their reputation, and felt, frankly, that it may not have been that big a deal.
Well, I mean, I think that latter view, that it may not be such a big deal, is, I think, perhaps something that we're evolving to. You know, especially JuicyCampus.com is aimed at college students, not grade school students, high school students, and I do think college students, you know, are developing thicker skins about this, and I think that's probably a healthy thing. On the other hand, although I don't think we've seen a test relating to JuicyCampus.com, There are a broad range of lawsuits that are brought against anonymous posters, and if they have valid claims for defamation or other, you know, legal claims against the anonymous posters, the courts will allow the anonymity to be breached. And so, in fact, as I was teaching my law school class last week, anonymity online is really it's pseudonymity. It's usually not anonymous. Usually, your anonymity can be breached, and when you compare that to just, for example, if I were to print up a flyer and go put it under the windshield of every car around this town hall during a city council meeting, that would be very, very anonymous. It would be very hard to identify who did that, especially if I paid a kid $5 to go put the flyer there. While in fact, if you do that exact kind of commentary online, criticizing a city council, that has directly led to lawsuits and attempts to breach the anonymity. So anonymity online is a concern, but it's something that the courts are able to deal with if there's a valid claim.
Let's take it back to Kate.
May I just add something to what John was saying? John, I've been following the Juicy Campus case pretty thoroughly, and actually the New Jersey Attorney General is taking action against them because they take a claim that always juicy, always anonymous, and they say that they don't tie the IP address to the individual posts. But ironically, they did and helped in an investigation with a bomb threat from L.A., which showed that they did tie IP to content. So in this case, actions are being taken against them for consumer fraud for not living up to the anonymity promise that they give all of their users. But I expect some more legal action against them soon.
Reg Weaver, let's take this to the K-12 level. When should students become concerned about how their online records might affect their chances of getting into college or their chances of landing a job?
Well, I think they should be concerned right off of the bat. However, if in fact they are not aware of what the consequences of bad behavior as a result of utilizing the internet, then I think they're not going to understand it. So again, the education of kids, the education of parents, is extremely important as it relates to this particular topic. And as we know, this is a topic that is relatively new, and a lot of the terms, a lot of the opportunities that exist to damage individuals, I think it's not readily understood the way it should be. And so I think that we have an ongoing responsibility to try to educate not only the kids but also the parents as it relates to the cyberbullying and what it could possibly hold for people who participate in it, and what the consequences of such actions might be if, in fact, a kid is found to be acting inappropriately. What's the impact on their future?
Here's Sadat in McLean, Virginia. Sadat, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. Gojo, I've been waiting for quite a long while, and obviously this is a very important issue. I just want to, I'm a bit confused because I want to know first of all, internet flaming, as somebody has pointed out, is something which is pervasive even amongst adults. We are talking about issues which relate to morals, ethics, and the way of behavior. So we're not talking about criminal acts on the internet. So where does the onus lie? Not on the parents to bring up children and to guide them properly? I mean, in the U.S., there's a tendency for a growth industry on everything. And now I think you should have invited Miss Manners rather than lawyers on this program.
Because you think this is a growth industry for litigation? Is that what you're thinking?
No, not litigation, but I mean having seminars, having public money spent on telling people how to behave. I mean, the first thing is that I've not heard anybody talk about the onus being on the parents who invest in a computer, who bring up children. I mean, they should really be telling them how to behave, whether you're anonymous. I know, internet is just a tool.
Okay, allow me.
The way you behave with people.
Allow me to ask one parent here, John Morris.
Well, I mean, my perception is that actually, you know, schools, Reg's group, and organizations like Perry's group are in fact very active in trying to promote programs that both teach the kids about the online reality and safety issues and concerns, but also really do try to teach parents that they have a responsibility to supervise their kids and to ultimately teach their kids values. I mean, I think the caller is exactly right that at the end of the day, it is the parents that really need to instill the values into their children. And schools play an important role. Organizations, advocacy groups play an important role in that. But at the end of the day, parents really need to teach their kids how to behave.
You know, Adam Thera,
I think you're absolutely right. And then, you know, I think a simple thing that parents can do is to keep computers in a common area so that they know exactly where the computers are being used by the kids. And also, take the bullying seriously. And if, in fact, your child is being harassed, then I think the parent ought to consider filing a complaint with the internet or the phone provider.
You know, a Google search on someone who ended up on the wrong end of an online attack might turn up the ugly stuff first. Adam, how can people who've had their names dragged through the mud repair their online reputations?
Well, interestingly enough, there actually are some services that are developing out there that will help you scrub down your past, if you will, or go out and try to eliminate from public view some things you might have said that were unfortunate from the past. But I think John Morris made a good point earlier that in the future, just about everyone who's an employer or looking to hire people is going to have been on Facebook or MySpace themselves. They're going to recognize that some of these things were said and done, were done in the heat of the moment or as a typical kind of thing that an immature youth might do to express themselves in ways that an adult would not. So part of this is society adjusting to these facts, but let's face it. I mean, we do have to, as parents and as stewards of our children, find new ways to instill within them morals in the internet age and to find a way to have a good set of netiquette rules for their families. The best way to do that for parents, my advice would be set forth some rules and make sure there are consequences. And if your kids cross those lines in schools or online in any fashion, make clear to them that there is going to be some hell to pay. And then enforce it somehow. Take away their computer or their cell phones for a week. That might be a good start.
And, of course, try to make sure that you are as close to being as tech-savvy as your children as you possibly can.
Indeed.
We know that sometimes that's very difficult. But I'm afraid we're just about out of time. Reg Weaver, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you so much.
Reg Weaver is president of the National Education Association. Perry Aftab, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And hopefully all of you will get involved on this issue moving forward.
Perry Aftab is executive director of WiredSafety.org. Adam Thera, thank you for joining us.
Thanks.
Adam is senior fellow at the Progress and Freedom Foundation. That's a market-oriented think tank that studies the digital revolution and its implications for public policy. And John Morris, good to see you again. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Kajak.
John is general counsel at the Center for Democracy and Technology and an adjunct professor at the Cardoza School of Law. Thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi. Coming up tomorrow on the Kojo Nandi Show, figuring out why innocent people sometimes get convicted of crimes, rooting out flaws, biases, and mistakes in Virginia's criminal justice system. Plus, bulging waistlines could lead to expanded legal protections, a new civil rights movement to prevent discrimination based on weight and appearance. The Kojo Nandi Show, noon till 2 tomorrow on WAMU 88.5.
Good afternoon. I'm Matt McCleskey. The second hour of today.